BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Radio Daleks. The show is coming to you from the Bristol Radio Co-op studio in the centre of town. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston, thanks to their local radio and all over the world who are accessing the show on the internet. We have two studio guests this week, Elaine Everly, who's here to talk about a book that she's written about her autistic son Guy. It's called Notes from a Literal Life. That interview will be followed by our very own Dialect What's On presenter, Jess Sparks, talking about fundraising walks for the National Autistic Society. Casey Riley tells us about her shop Elsie Riley in Broad Street, in the city centre on Broad Street, which is the one with the Thistle Hotel and formerly the Ark Bar. And they've got a promotion next month called Made in Bristol. We've also got features by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, our dialect reporters. Malcolm Greaves has ever reads another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary later on by John Fothergill, which is set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. And as ever, Jeff Sparks is back to bring us the latest on What's On. I'm John Peters Coleman, and I'd like to present our first guest straight away, who is Elaine Everly. Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you for coming in. You've written a book called Notes from a Literal Life, which is published by Chipmunker, £10 a copy. Tell us a little bit about how you started to write this book and what the main theme of the book is about.
It's a book about my son, basically, who was born a long time ago in 1961, and it's his life story in a way, but it's written by me, and so a lot of my life story has crept in, and there's a lot of social history because, as I say, things have changed a lot.
Yeah.
And in fact, the word autism wasn't around when he was born.
Okay.
So it was more like a mentally handicapped was.
I mean, autism kind of covers such a wide spectrum, from sort of mildly aspergic, which, you know, to most people means that you can kind of cope in society relatively well, but might have difficulty trying to have a conversation, straight through to very severe, almost sort of totally disabled. Where does your son fit in this wide range?
It's very difficult because I totally agree with you. It's a spectrum disorder, so it starts mild. I would say that in some ways it's quite serious, in so much I'd hardly let him cross the road on his own, but in some ways he was late talking, late walking. But in other ways, he is like a very young child. And where he lives in Clevedon, they wouldn't let him out on his own, for instance. So that he really is a bit reliant on us for going out. But we go out with him and have all his life, you know. We go down the Duke and, you know, anywhere. He's part of the scene.
Yeah. So how if the word autism didn't really exist? I mean, 1961, the first Beatles LP hasn't even come out yet. How do you come to think, well, something's not quite right with the son? He's not quite the same as everybody else. Who tells you what's wrong? What happens?
That's what the book's basically about, really, is rather discovering and coming to terms with the fact that you've got a handicapped child, because it wasn't apparent when he was born. He was quite, you know, a good-looking little baby, and he was very difficult baby, I would say. He cried a lot and it made a fuss about absolutely everything, and he still does. I mean, even now at 47, you'd say, you know, he'll make a fuss about silly little things. But that didn't make him handicapped. But I think the first thing that did was you compare him with other children and he was always behind. At first you guess it was a bit slow or he'll catch up.
How old is he at this point? So 4 or 5? Or
by the time he was 4, you knew he was different, but you didn't know that he was going to be different forever. You know, there wasn't a lot of help from the medical profession. I would say none. Nobody took much notice when I sort of said he cries a lot. I remember a doctor saying all babies cry, and you sort of leave it another year and say it's only when I went to send him to school I sent him to the local village school where I'd gone to school myself, Long Ashton, and they actually kept him there for a year. Looking back, I'm surprised they kept him there that long. And he went off to St. Christopher School, and then he went to what's called an ESN school in those days, educationally subnormal. And then he went to, even they found him hard work. I think he was hard work. I think his behaviour was a problem. Okay.
When did you first come across the word autism? When did somebody first say, I recognise what is going on here, rather than him just being hard work or slow? Or
well, I think he was already really classified as mentally handicapped, but it wasn't spelled out. There was no... Except that the fact that he wasn't in mainstream schooling is, you know, obviously that shows that he was certainly handicapped. But nobody actually quite knew what the word autism meant in those days. I'd heard the word and I'd looked it up. In fact, I looked up quite a lot about mental handicap, but I was not a lot wiser, better informed. And I just, people would say, oh, I suspect he's autistic. And what they really would try and insinuate was to be autistic was to be a sort of trapped intelligence or bright, really, but it doesn't show, which if it doesn't show, it's not much good you. And so I would say that he was, the word autistic, I didn't apply to him, and it was never actually used by a medical person. It was only when I read about sort of, and this book goes on about all these things.
Yeah. But so when you start...
I was quite an, he was an adult before I actually used the word. I read about somebody with Asperger's syndrome.
So we're talking about the 70s or the 80s by
this
point. Yes,
I think I was reading something in a magazine, Sunday Times, and I thought, gosh, because they were using the word Asperger's and he sounded so like Guy. Well, I would say this child was a lot brighter than Guy, but I could see the sort of behaviour things that are connected with autism, which is sort of very obsessional.
Hmm. And where does he still live with you now?
No, he lives in Clevedon, but he spends a lot of time with us, weekends. And
okay, so where does he live? Does he live in a care home or a facility of some sort?
Well, it's a house on the front in Clevedon, and it's for people with learning difficulties, I presume, adults.
Yeah.
And they are, I don't think it's for people with autism, but the trouble is because it's such a sort of vague thing, it crosses over. It was never called autism, as you know, once. So that it was all under the general heading of mental handicap. You know, like once there was only one cancer, now there's a million. And I suppose it's the same with mental handicap. They've all got their own little niches, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just people who aren't very capable of looking after themselves, I suppose. And he lives there and he goes to a day centre and he comes home weekends or comes on holiday with us or we go down there or my husband might go and pick him up and go down to the pub and play cards.
I mean, I suppose some of people who are autistic, as I sort of understand it, have no sort of sense of self in the traditional sense. So do you think, for example, if when you're not there, that he sort of misses, he knows who you and your husband are and he misses you? Or
I think he totally knows who we are.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the cat knows who we are. Do you know what I mean? Of course he knows who we are in a way. I never, this is why I didn't think he was autistic at first, because it was as though it was people who didn't relate their families or who'd been separated at birth. But I would say that he was totally aware of who we are, talks about us, very, very aware of family, very aware of the past, very good
memory. So he's certainly aware enough to miss you if you're not around and he
asks about you. He's because he's a bit obsessional about numbers and dates, he will talk about numbers, dates, and when he's going to see us, what year, next year.
What do you mean by obsessional? Elaborate on that a little bit. What did that mean? You know, how is he obsessional when he's around? What's he like?
He talks about, he's very date minded, he's very numerical, and I think lots of people with autism are like that. So he counts everything, and from an early age he didn't speak much, but he'd say do you remember when we went so and so? He might say 10 people, and he'd just go by the number, including the cat, the dog or anything else.
Right.
And he will say, what are you doing on the 27th? And that'll be sort of next Christmas or something, you know. He's always looking ahead, or when the Duke of Edinburgh dies or whatever. It's hard to explain, but he is...
Do you feel that any of that has rubbed off on you at all?
I don't think I'm like that. I don't think I'm like that by nature. I don't think we're alike.
But do you feel that you do understand, you must understand more about how his mind works?
Oh, obviously, yes, yeah. Because if you live with anybody, you get to know them. Obviously, we know him very well,
yeah.
And he knows us, and he...
But do you catch yourself kind of thinking, he would think like this in this situation, so you kind of feel like you kind of think
yes,
like that?
Yes, you'd think
almost.
He'd like this or he'd like that.
Yeah.
He definitely talks about the past a lot. He's very aware of the past, in a way.
Okay, do you feel you're going to write any more about your son? What do you hope for the future for your son?
Well, I think the future's already happened. I don't know. He's sort of, I think what he's missed, he can't get back. You know, there wasn't special, I don't think his education wasn't all bad. I mean, he went to school in Weston, and so I suppose he was there till he was 18. He now goes to a day centre, and I suppose he's lucky to have a place. But I don't think he's ever going to do a job or anything, because he wouldn't want to, you know.
Okay. I'm afraid we kind of ran out of time a little bit there, but I'll just plug your book. Chipmunka Publishing, Chipmunka being Chip and M-U-N-K-A Publishing. And in fact, if you Google Notes from a Literal Life, it comes up straight away, because I did it earlier on. Thank you very much, Elaine, for coming in, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
All right, now over to Jeff Sparks, who's in the hot seat at the moment. He's talking about fundraising for the National Autistic Society. This is in relation to a project they've got going on called Grand Intentions, which is apparently a new, fresh and fun fundraising initiative, which is all about stating your intention, what you want to do, and raising a grand to support the National Autistic Society in whichever way you wish. So what are you doing, Jeff?
Well, basically, I'm doing a series of sponsored walks, and the first one is on Sunday, July the 5th, along the Bristol and Bath Railway Path, which is about 13 miles, and starting at 10:30 in the morning at the St. Philip's Road entrance. And then the second walk I've got planned is 18 miles around Bristol, starting at Temple Meads, walking up around Clifton, Westbury on Trim, Henbury, then back around into Temple Meads. And yeah, that's 18 miles on 22nd of August.
Yeah.
And then the third walk I've got to raise £1,000 is walking from Bristol to Glastonbury on Friday, September the 4th.
That's pretty massive trek. How long is that?
24 miles.
24 miles.
And that's along the A roads and B roads. If it was along footpaths, like the Monarch's Way, it'd probably be about 30, 35 miles.
Okay.
So I've decided to go for the
shorter. Trimmed it a little bit.
Yeah.
Will you be wearing protective clothing to avoid getting run over? Fluorescent jackets?
I might do. I just like jump into the hedge just to save myself from getting run over.
Okay. Are you going to carry a plastic bag of dock leaves with you in case you get stung by nettles when you jump into the hedge?
That could be a good idea, yes.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Okay, are you going to be bringing a Walkman with you to amuse yourself? How are you going to amuse yourself for all of these many miles? What if you get bored and go to the pub? How do we know you haven't done that?
Well, I'll probably be in mobile contact with friends and, you know.
Okay, well, we wish you all the very best of luck. Just to tell you a little bit about the National Autistic Society, I'm sure you kind of gathered the concept of what it's about by the title, but they're currently the UK's leading charity of people affected by autism, and they were founded in 1962 by a group of parents who are passionate about ensuring a better future for their children. And I'm sure if you Google that as ever, or Bing it, in fact, which is Microsoft's new search engine, you will come up with it straight away. Very best of luck to Jeff, and thanks to Taunton Leisure, a little plug for them, because they are sponsoring Jeff. Taunton Leisure are based at 38 to 42 Bedminster Parade in Bedminster, no less. Oh, and the main way to sponsor Jeff, oh, I nearly forgot this, www.justgiving.com/Jeff Sparks, which you spell with an E, S-P-A-R-K-E-S.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Our next guest is Katie Riley, who has a shop called Elsie Riley after her grandmother in Broad Street, just by the Thistle Hotel in the heart of Bristol. And next month, the shop is promoting Made in Bristol. Hello, Katie.
Hello.
Tell me a little bit about your shop, Elsie Riley. How long have you been open?
We've been open in about 2.5 years now. It'll be 3 years this October. And we are an independent. It's my first shop, so the Made in Bristol promotion is to basically promote the fact that we support local artists in and around Bristol.
Cool, okay. Just as a point of curiosity, you named it after your grandmother. Why did you name your shop after your grandmother?
Because basically the product we sell is very vintage inspired, and her name sounded very vintage, so it's a very girly name, and cool. It suited the shop, and it's a kind of, I don't know, My grandma was a seamstress herself, so it all seemed to tie in.
Okay, so as for people who haven't been in your shop, just sort of give me a little sort of virtual tour. What do people find when they walk in your shop?
Okay, we're mainly clothes, but we also do jewellery, shoes, bags, accessories, gifts, cards. It's just a little treasure trove, and it's been described as a girly sweetie shop.
Okay.
So yeah, it's very girly, but there's, you know, the price range starts from £2 up to £150, and there's something in there for everybody, really, I think.
Okay. Why did you think Made in Bristol? Why do you want to promote Bristol local people?
It started off because I realised all of a sudden, after 2.5 years, I've actually managed to get at least 8 stockets of local designers and artists, and one of them being an employee called Hannah, and she's just finished her fashion degree at UWE and done a beautiful, beautiful collection of dresses. Just taking them down to London, Graduate Fashion Week, and I just thought, well, how fantastic. Cool. To promote her initially was, I said, well, you know, put it in the window. And I thought, oh, what a great idea. We could do a whole Made in Bristol idea and promote everybody within the store, and hopefully that will encourage other designers and artists to bring their work to me. It makes us very unique, and it gives them an outlet for them to showcase their products.
Okay. Have you found a lot of untapped talent in Bristol?
Loads.
Yeah?
There's loads, and there's loads more out there, I'm pretty sure.
So okay, what sort of thing are you looking for, perhaps? Somebody's out there, you sell all kinds of things, it sounds like.
All kinds of things, like from, yeah, anything girly. Gifts, jewellery, cards, handbags, scarves, accessories, anything. If it doesn't clash with something that we've already got, then, yeah, we'll give it a go if it's good quality.
Okay.
And a good price, yeah.
So what were you doing before you ran this shop?
I was a lingerie designer.
Ah.
For Marks and Spencer's.
Okay.
And got made redundant. So, it seemed like a great opportunity to do what I've always wanted to do. So I went to the bank a few times, I might add, with my business plan.
Yeah.
And eventually, yeah, they said yes. So 2.5 years later, here I am. And fingers crossed, credit crunch and that, people will still want to come and buy treaty things and treat themselves and you know, their loved ones.
Okay, I mean, running an independent shop is very difficult, obviously, and currently in the economic climate of the Depression and credit crunch and so forth. How have you found meeting up to the challenge of not only running a first shop, but also running that headlong into a sort of an economic crisis? What has that been like for you?
Very, very worrying. And obviously, when Cabot Circus opened, that was quite scary, because I thought everyone would end up walking to the other side of town. But actually, I think it's brought more people into the city centre, and we just take it day by day with regard to credit crunch. Sometimes we have a quiet day and I worry, and then other days I'm like, what am I worried about? This is great. Everyone's coming in and being, everyone's so supportive and very positive, which is what keeps me going. It's the local Bristolians that keep me going.
Yeah. There are a lot of clothes shops in Cabot Circus. So what did you look around them? What did you make of the
Well, they're all high street, you know, same in any other city, so I don't think they're too much of a worry. Now that it's open, I realise it's not so much competition as it's a necessity that every city needs a high street, and we're an independent. I like to put us in a different bracket.
Okay, so we've kind of established you've certainly got an individualistic kind of bent. You're a very unique, independent kind of shop compared to some of the stuff that's going on in Cabot Circus. I mean, how do you sort of match up price-wise? Do people sort of have to pay out an extra buck for
this? Is something
kind of
that we started off, and my plan in the first instance was to open a boutique that's, although individual and unique, but affordable. And I think that's the key at the moment, is to make things affordable, but as long as they're good quality, it's unique, we're offering something completely different to the high street. Just naming a few of the designers that we've got within store at the moment, we have Hermione Berry, who makes freshwater pearl jewellery, and that's one of our high-end jewellery products at the moment, which, you know, can start at £35 for a pair of earrings and go up to £180 for a necklace. But that's definitely our top end. We start our normal costume jewellery from, you know, £6-7. It's everything's very affordable. But yeah, I mean, here to promote the local artists, and we have quite a few who are doing artwork for us at the moment, including
okay.
Fiona, who does vintage glass mirrors with her own screen printing on.
Yep.
We have Debbie Saunders, who does flower collages, loads of different sizes, you do them any colour. Everything's, you know, can be made to order on commission, which makes it really nice, very unique present for a friend or family.
Okay. What kind of people come into your shop on a day-to-day basis? I'm imagining it's kind of, I don't know, mostly sort of younger girls.
Not at all. From age 18 to 75. There is no age bracket. generally a lot of the time in the week at lunchtimes, it's you know, I don't know, 25 to 45 working mums and single girls. Oh, I don't know what I'm talking about.
And when I went in, there was also sort of quite a few bits and bobs, which did look like the kind of excellent kind of thing you'd buy your mum when you really have no idea what the hell you're going to buy her for her birthday.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, and I wish you all the very best of luck with Made in Bristol. It's in Broad Street, and your website address?
How can people get in touch? lcreilly.com.
lcreilly.com. That's very easy to remember. And that's in Broad Street, which is the one with the Thistle Hotel and the Lab Bar on, just there. Very easy to find. Thank you to Tony Gosling for our next feature. It does require somewhat a prerequisite knowledge, if that's the right word, about what the square mile is. Not the Green Mile, which is a film about Death Row. No, the Square Mile is the business district in the centre of London, which, according to my memory of school textbooks, is full of very anonymous-looking tower blocks and people in sort of pink shirts with white collars and cuffs talking to giant mobile phones the size of bricks going, 50,000 or the deal's off! If you see that, you're probably in the Square Mile in London. This is a book about it by Geraint Anderson, who Tony Gosling's met up with, a city boy and a whistleblower. So now we're getting the Tony Gosling angle. The book's called Beer and Loathing in the Square Mile.
It's a Wild West casino, or at least it became that. It's a bunch of mainly white young men making as much money as quickly as possible. It's quite a tight club, it's quite a closed club, and it's about doing what is necessary to get as rich as quickly as possible, with not too many rules preventing you doing that.
But it's terrible, I mean...
Well, it's what the natural product of 15 years or so of deregulation. People have a propensity to be greedy. The city attracts very intelligent people because the rewards are so high. And those people are going to find out how to abuse the bonus system. So something like the Jerome Kerviel scandal, you could argue, is a logical product of the system. And my colleagues and I were told many times that this casino was going to close down soon. There was going to be some form of crisis. And so the logical way to behave again was to make as much money as we could.
That's what you did.
I went in there assuming that I would be found out at any minute because I was just a left-wing hippie who fell into a job by mistake. Of course, the problem is that you start earning good money quickly and then it's a very hard job to leave. In fact, I felt like a bank robber. I promised myself I'd do 5 years. I ended up doing 12. There are many people who promise themselves they'd do 5 years and they're still doing it 30 years later with two divorces and, you know, a big mortgage and school fees. So I managed to escape eventually and with some money in my pocket.
You describe a lot of excess. I don't know if it's in English the same. Can you just give me a few examples?
Yeah, it was the boom times, or what Gordon Brown has called the age of irresponsibility. Excess was the order of the day. You know, not only was it excessive money you were earning, I mean, I was earning, my last two bonuses were £500,000. I still don't know why they paid me that. I can't work it out. Alcohol drinking was quite excessive. There's a big culture of drinking in London anyway. Drugs obviously go hand in hand with rich young men who like alcohol, like the buzz of the trading floor. And, of course, corporate activity, The stock markets were booming up until 2 years ago. There was just, the strip joints were absolutely full of city boys. And I took people out on nights that cost several thousand pounds. There was a lot of excess around.
Mm-hmm. So you, why did you decide to leave this world?
I always had misgivings about the job. I had a fairly left-wing, you know, hippie background. I just wanted to get in, get out quickly. I became attracted by the money. I became slightly corrupted by it. But when the opportunity came to actually expose it in a form of an anonymous column in a London newspaper, I was very, very happy to do so because there were so many things I saw that disagreed with me. You know, the greed, the short-termism, the arrogance, the conspicuous consumption, the insider trading, spreading false rumours, avoiding tax. It kind of disgusted my ideals and my ethics.
And what do you think now that you are you leave the city for, I don't know, 6 months or something?
One year. Yeah.
So now what opinion do you have on the city now?
Well, it needs to change because I think hopefully the mentality and the environment that I describe in the book City Boy is shown to be the reality. You know, what the crisis that has occurred that is going to affect millions of lives across the world was a crisis created by bankers. And those bankers did what they did because they were greedy, ruthless people who wanted to increase their bonus, even if it meant long-term bad consequences for us all. So my vision of the city hasn't changed at all. I just feel that events have proven it to be more correct than perhaps, you know, or have proven it to be correct to the general public more than I had shown, perhaps.
But do you think it will change?
The city itself is obviously a not so much fun place to be at the moment. All my ex-colleagues who I speak to, they're either worried about losing their jobs, have lost their jobs. Their bonuses this last year were down about 60% on average. There's got to be tighter regulation because the politicians are listening to the voters, hopefully, and the voters will not stand for another crisis created by bankers. There'll be tighter regulation. There'll be the bonus system, I think, will change quite dramatically, and there will be banks will have greater controls placed on them because otherwise we'll just have another credit crunch type event, another financial crisis in the next 10 years, and then there'll be blood on the streets this time.
Yeah, because the G20 leaders announced big change, but, you know, we have to see. Mm. Do you feel it will be... it will really change? I mean, it's just promises.
I think there will be changes because there's enough political will and there's a big energy to make change, and everyone, you know, the politicians need to show their voters that they mean business. However, it's really hard to do global coordination in any kind of way because if London imposes lots of regulations, so does Wall Street, then suddenly Dubai or maybe Zurich or somewhere else becomes a new financial centre because unfortunately finance is very movable. It's very transportable. If I have a computer and an internet, you know, I can be a hedge fund manager in Shanghai, London, or Caracas.
You said at the end of the book that you regret, I don't know if it's you or your character,
they're both the same.
Okay, that you will regret some things, but what?
I say in the book what I'll regret is having a tall blonde woman on one arm and a rolled up note, 20 note on the other. I won't really regret that. Maybe I will. I miss the kind of brotherhood you have to some extent. You know, the banter, the talking within a group and a team. I miss to some extent the Michelin-starred restaurants. I miss going to Miami and Vegas for 5 days. I miss, I suppose, you know, being a writer now is quite a lonely job. You're on your own in front of a computer. But to be honest with you, I don't miss much of it. I don't miss getting up at 6 in the morning. I don't miss talking to aggressive traders. I don't miss talking to arrogant clients. I am very happy taking lots of holidays, doing work for some work for charity and writing another book.
Okay, last question. When I've been to the city and ask people if they feel guilty, you not the bankers in general, do you feel guilty for what's happened now, or a part of this?
Well, you know, if you ask people in the city, no one is to blame for what happened, because if they work in commodities or equities or bonds or foreign exchange, and they all say it was not us, it was people in structured finance, specifically people in mortgage-backed securities, who are to blame for the whole problem. I would say that we were all playing in the same casino, and we just happened to be, I happened to be at the roulette table, and the people who did the real bad thing were at the poker table. So I do feel some guilt. In fact, I've actually said I've done 12 years sinning, and now I have to do 12 years redemption. So I am trying to do some good now, to try and make up for the wrongdoing that I helped create, because I was part of the problem, not part of the solution. I was part of a system that's basically making this world a polluted place with climate change and an increasingly, I think, divided society where money is the one true God. Not a happy place. So I need to try and help do my bit to improve that.
Yes. But you have the money to do what you do now.
Yeah. Well, I could just sit on a beach drinking pina coladas. However, I've decided that I'd like to do something a bit more worthwhile than that. I'd prefer I'm trying to raise money to build a school in Kenya, and hopefully if that works, then we'll do more things. And I've got other books to write. Unfortunately, we in the city have got we've got brains that are, I think, quite active, so I can't just sit around smoking dope.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to Tony on that feature, and to Geraint Anderson for the interview. Now for some music, let's hear Pulp with Sorted for Ease and Whiz.
No way, not today makes you wonder what it meant to know. And this hollow feeling grows and grows and grows and grows. And you want to call your mother and say, Mother, I can never come home again. Because I seem to have left an important part of my brain. Somewhere, somewhere in a field in Hampshire, all right.
That was Pulp, now sadly defunct, with Sorted for Reason Wiz from a very long time ago. It's now time for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves. A story set in Oxfordshire in the 1920s. If you remember, John Fothergill set out in 1922 out of the need to earn a living, so he decided to move to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to, so he wrote about his experiences in a diary, and we have them. The intro music is a tune called Old Molly Oxford and was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Naval Volunteer Pub, which you can find in King Street in Bristol if you've not already been there. And if you want to play with them, you can meet up every Tuesday for an impromptu jam. You can just turn up and join in.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Proper innkeeping. It is easy for a grocer to decide what quality of goods he will sell to his best advantage. But he needn't trouble about the quality of the people he sells them to. Nor does any hotel keeper. He leaves it to luck, and so to ill luck. I've never heard it said of any hotel that they have any particular class of people as clientele, unless it be some residential place where they can easily pick and choose. Here, I've determined not only to have proper and properly cooked food, but to have only either intelligent, beautiful, or well-bred people to eat it, although barely paying our way. We've declined dozens of applications for rooms simply because we don't know the people, or the writing or the address don't please. To several of the commoner undergraduates, I've said that I don't want them here with indiscriminate girls, and yet some people will argue with me that I am compelled by law to take them in and feed them. My answer is, either I give them bread and cheese in a back room, or fill the place rapidly with men and prostitutes, or the undesirable kind of undergraduate, and let go the polite atmosphere that pervades the place, and our polite staff too. Few realise what I go through to get and keep for it the atmosphere this place now has. After all, innkeeping is the only profession where one's business is also one's home. If it be thought eccentric or arrogant to encourage only certain kinds of people to share your roof and floor, is this not, in fact, always done? The beery innkeeper has beery friends, and discourages the others, and so on. And the man who has no particular character or leanings, but thinks of his hotel first and his home as last, merely makes a characterless business out of it. 3 years have gone, and still no one comes here to stay in the winter, save a few flukes, accidents, or thunderstorms. But I stick to my opinion that there are enough decent people to people this inn, and until we are known to all these, we can remain empty. During a recent bank holiday, none of the 5 delightful but quite incompatible parties knew that they were being manoeuvred daily and nightly to sit in different rooms and places in the house, with fires so as to keep them separate, whilst the big drawing-room with a blazing fire at each end was left in possession of a party of 4 who got there first, and who read aloud to one another all evening. On the whole, I've decided that it's not good to scrap with your clients, even if only because it takes too much out of you to win, should the client really want to finish it out. But certain people have to be tamed. When there are plenty of decent folk about, quite happy and content, it seems unjust that someone should be trying on airs, as he well might against a lot of foreign waiters in one of a chain of hotels owned by a man in London. A red-haired man with a pretty woman chose to be nasty instead of mildly amused at the menu. "What does the big three mean?" which I'd written for short instead of beef, pork and mutton. And then he said, "Mavrodafun trifle," meant nothing to him. "Anyhow, the food will," I pleasantly replied, and told him that if he had used his intelligence, he could quite understand the big three. To which he replied, quite properly, I suppose, that he didn't want to use his intelligence. When I was out cutting his food, Kate told me he had made a very unpleasant entrance, so I took the meat to him, in order the more to tame him. He said he had come 80 miles here to lunch. I said, "You mean to pick a quarrel? How's that?" "Well, you arrived in a very disagreeable mood, and I'm ever so pleased to see you so agreeable now." And so we became friends. I think this must be the last scrap I shall induce. It is beastly enough to play the pig in an hotel, but it's still worse for the host to be a pig too, for he has such an advantage over his guest. If I ever had a private house again, I should feel badly the want of a sign outside. Even the open house that some people keep is generally arduous and expensive compared with what an hotel can be, with all its surprises if run strictly to a standard of breeding and intelligence. You are doing something, the door opens, and you go to meet it. It is not a visitor whom you have invited weeks ago, arriving now reluctantly, only to find the feeling mutual since your moods have changed meantime. No one visits you out of duress or courtesy. So you know you are desired at the moment. And what is easier than to take up the feeling? Comfortable words. I ask Lord What's-His-Name, a nice appreciative newcomer, what brought him to such a godforsaken place as this. "I use the RAC book. But what on earth brought you?" "A sense of humour." Mrs. Scratton said this evening that she resented people coming here, as she felt it like a private house. Mrs. Sefton Cohen told me that Sefton Cohen, a government prosecutor, asked her to remind him to pay the bill, as it was the last thing one would think about doing here. Beautiful Henrietta Bingham came late to dinner with a friend at the fag end of the food. They had a shabby meal, and I told them why. "We've enjoyed it immensely," said H.B. "The ends of your dinners are better than the beginnings at other places," which was as prettily said as it was untrue. But the motive was good. Such compliments are indeed nourishing. But there are people who tell me how jolly it must be to keep an hotel. These are the very people who would be generally incapable of doing the work, or attending to the detail which alone makes an inn fit for decent people, and good for compliments.
Thank you very much to Malcolm, and you can hear another instalment next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Thank you to Anthea Page for our next feature. This week is Refugee Week in Bristol, and our reporter went to see the screening of a film called Forced to Flee. This interview is with Eleanor Harris, who is the area manager for Refugee Action based in Bristol. But before that, we'll hear a little bit of African music from the Kora, K-O-R-A, a 21-string West African harp lute. The sharp-eared amongst you will have heard us play this before, but this one is performed by the Kora Workshop, and it's called Khalifa Ba. The Kora Workshop is opening a Kora making and playing centre in Senegal next year. If you want to find out a little bit more about that, or you like the music, if you just Google the Kora Workshop, it comes up immediately.
I'm the area manager for Refugee Action based in Bristol.
Can you tell us about Refugee Week?
Refugee Week is happening at the moment, so as you're listening to this, Refugee Week is going on around you. It's a national week which tries to celebrate the contribution of refugees in the UK, and it also tries to celebrate the concept of sanctuary, this safety that we're giving people, and the fact that we're saving people's lives.
What more could be done to help refugees, do you think?
There's an enormous amount, really. A refugee is someone who has fled persecution, who's been given protection in this country and has to start their life again from scratch, probably having lost everything, not knowing about the system in this country, not knowing how to find work, not knowing maybe some of the cultural things, not knowing how to say hello, not knowing how to try and integrate, which people want to do. But I think probably one of the things that people could do is say hello. People could be friendly. And there's something called a Simple Acts campaign, which is trying to encourage people to just take one simple act which could help a refugee integrate and settle in their new life in this country. And you can find out about the Simple Acts on the internet if you have it. It's www.refugeeweek/simpleacts.
Now, today we saw a film and it was called Forced to Flee.
Yeah.
There were some shocking facts that came out of that film about when people are refused asylum status. Mm-hmm. Many of them have to turn to destitution. Can you just expand on that?
It's quite difficult to explain, really, because the asylum system is incredibly complicated. But basically what happens is that people who come and claim asylum are saying, please, I am fleeing for my life because back home I will be persecuted or tortured or killed, and I need protection. Now, when the government looks at those claims for protection, it looks at something called the Geneva Convention, which has a very, very narrow definition of the people who are entitled to refugee status. So about 25% of the people who ask for it are given refugee status, 75% of the people who ask for it are not, and they're refused. Now, their stories are pretty much the same as the people who were given refugee status, who were given protection, but because of a technicality sometimes, they don't meet the definition, so they are refused. They may be unable to go back. They're people from places like Zimbabwe, Eritrea, Sudan, Somalia, where it's simply too dangerous to go back, but they also are refused asylum. When they're in that situation, they're no longer entitled to government support because they've been refused. They can't go home because it's too dangerous or they've got no way of getting there. And they're not allowed to work. So if you take all of those three options, you say, what's left? Well, actually, nothing. And that's why people end up in that situation.
But some of the women end up in prostitution.
We do know of, I wouldn't say it's a large number, we do know of women who have been forced into prostitution because they're not allowed to work, they're not allowed to claim benefits, and they can't go back. Well, you've got to eat somehow. You've got to have money. You can't live without money. And for them, prostitution in this country, however incredibly degrading, is actually better than what they would face if they went back home.
Do you think the government is turning their back on people?
I think it's being unrealistic. What the government is saying is, look, you've been refused asylum, so therefore you can go back. It's washing its hands of the whole situation. If you've got thousands of people being refused asylum who can't go home, then, well, the government can give them temporary protection. The government used to do that. It used to say, look, OK, you don't meet the definition of a refugee, but we accept you can't go back at the moment. Maybe in 2 or 3 years your country will be safe. But at the moment it's not. So you can stay and you can work and you can become a member of society and you can contribute. And that was made much more sense. At the moment those people are being refused. And yes, the government is turning its back on the situation. There's no doubt about it.
What about breach of human rights?
It's a lawyer's question, really. A human rights law is in itself incredibly complex, so I don't think I'm qualified to answer the question. I would say on a humane level, it's a breach of a person's dignity and safety. On a legal level, you'd have to ask a solicitor about that one.
Some of the people who are refugees, they've got qualifications. People, and they could be used to good cause, couldn't they? Doctors, nurses?
People who are refugees are exactly the same as you and me and all the people that we know, the people we bump into in the street, the people we go to for help. Refugees are no different from us. So therefore, refugees from all over the world include people who are engineers and who are doctors and who are teachers and who are farmers and who are journalists and who are government officials and who are bus drivers. They include everybody, because being a refugee is not a career choice. Being a refugee is something appalling that happens to you.
So isn't it rather a waste if people are destitute because they're not contributing the skills that they have to this country?
That's absolutely right. And what most refugees say to us, or most refused asylum seekers say to us, is, look, I don't want government support. I don't want benefits. Where I come from, there isn't such a thing as a benefit system. That's not why I came here. I came here to be safe and to work. And that's what I want to do.
Do you think the media could do more to help the image of refugees? Do you think some of the media put across a bad image?
The media is very confused a lot of the time. It confuses everybody else. Some of the media are very good. A lot of the media in Bristol has been really great the last few years about talking about the positive aspects of refugees, about giving safety to people in Bristol and being proud of that. And, as you say, about the fact that refugees have skills and determination, an enormous inspiration to give us. Some of the media, on the other hand, and I would say this is more the national media, do confuse asylum seekers who are coming for safety with economic migrants who are coming for a job, completely different things. They talk about things like bogus and illegal. They make up stories about asylum seekers which are not true. They say that asylum seekers get more money than other people on benefits, which is simply not a fact. They say that asylum seekers get free housing off the council, which they don't at all in Bristol. So they make up a lot of stories which sort of poison us, I think, against a group of people who actually are asking for our protection.
So it's about enlightenment, really?
It is about enlightenment. It's about giving people proper information and about not demonising a group of people who, as I say, really have come here to say, look, save me, please.
If people want to find out more about asylum seekers and refugees, what's the website? Not the Refugee Week website, mm-hmm. but your own website.
We have a website for Refugee Action, which is www.refugee-action.org.uk. If you go onto that website, you can also find a lot of links, not just to about what Refugee Action does, but about other organisations working with refugees and asylum seekers and about the facts about asylum rather than the myths.
And can someone who is a refugee access that as well and get information and help?
That's a really good question. There's links from our website to a lot of websites in different languages which give information and advice in different languages to people seeking asylum and to new refugees.
Thank you to Antia for the efforts there, and to the Choral Workshop as well. Jeff Sparks is here with us, telling us what's on. You always kind of hide your T-shirt a little bit with this large coat. It's like you're hiding your light under a bushel. Let's can peel back your extra layer and see it. Okay, we've got a very large Celtic cross. Is this the cross of St. David? Am I right in suggesting
I'm not sure, really.
You're not even sure. And it's got a massive dragon. Where did you? What's the theme for this week? What's the?
I seem to sort of wear it a bit different.
Okay, fair enough. Tell us what's going on.
Thank you. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 26th of June, and Ian Briggs and the Super Vampers will be performing at the Prom Bar in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Also on 26th of June, Psycho Delia Smith will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and I feature the Cardiff-based rock group Sal. To date, they have released an EP titled Infatuation and two albums, their debut titled Dysfunctional and their forthcoming album Conversations with My Therapist, which will be released on 29th of June. This is a track from Conversations with My Therapist and is titled Swallowed Pride for Hollow Promises. That was Saul with Swallowed Pride for Hollow Promises from the forthcoming album Conversations with My Therapist. On that album there is a song titled Devil May Care, which is a theme tune for the new James Bond audiobook by Sebastian Faulks. For more information on Saul, you can check out www.saultheband.co.uk. That is spelt S-A-L. Moving on to 27th of June, and the legendary group The Misfits will be performing at TJ's in Newport, Wales. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £17 in advance. Also on 27th of June, Steve Tilston will be performing at the Folk House in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 each. Finally, on 28th of June, Silver Sun Pickups will be performing with support from Animal Kingdom and Anne Horse. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much to Jeff. One of these weeks, he'll introduce the track of the week and give us the shock of his life and say, and this is Julio Iglesias with his 2005 hit. And we'll go, what? Get out. Just a reminder about the sponsored walk that Jeff is doing for the National Autistic Society. The web address is www.justgiving.com/Jeff Sparks. Which is JeffSparks. Well, that's all from Dalek Radio this week. In the studio were Elaine Everly talking about her book Notes from a Literal Life, and Katie Riley from the Elsie Riley Shop in Broad Street. So don't forget the information for that too. Notes from a Literal Life, if you Google that, it will come up straight away. You can find out about that. And the Elsie Riley Shop is in Broad Street, and the Made in Bristol is opening up in the next month. Thanks to the Choral Workshop for their track, and Malcolm Grieve for another chapter of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Features were by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Jeff Sparks brought us What's On in Bristol, and the studio engineer was Alistair Grant. The producer was Anthea Page, who also provided a captive team. I'm John Peters-Conley.